On behalf of the Interstate Technology and Regulatory Council, welcome to today's training, Enhanced Attenuation of Chlorinated Organics, a Site Management Tool. My name is Juliana Cheatham. I'm coming to you from Roxboro, North Carolina. I'm going to serve as a moderator on today's call. I'm going to cover introductory material in the next few slides and then quickly turn the presentation over to our instructors from the ITRC Enhanced Attenuation of Chlorinated Organics team. As listed on the slide, today's training is based on the Technical and Regulatory Guidance for Enhanced Attenuation Chlorinated Organics, the ECO-1 document. Today's training is an introduction to the document, and we do recommend that you refer to the document itself, and we'll take you to a link at the end of the training class where you can access the document. We also make available the presentation that you'll see during today's training class. In addition to what you'll see on the slides during today's class, the downloaded version includes speaker's notes section with additional information. And again, we'll take you to links at the end of the training where you can download both the document and the presentation. Today's training is sponsored by the Interstate Technology and Regulatory Council, ITRC, and is hosted by the U.S. EPA Cleanup Information Network, CLUIN. Please move to slide 2. If you're using the CLUIN system, it's a series of orange buttons along the top. And most often you'll be using the third button, the single right button arrow, to move forward one slide at a time through the presentation. Today's training course is scheduled for 2 hours. I have put all lines on mute so that we eliminate background noise, but we do ask that you do not put the call on hold. It is *6 to unmute your phone, but we ask that you wait until the question and answer breaks. For our phone line audience, you're welcome to ask questions out loud during the question and answer break. For our simulcast audience, the orange question mark button at the top of the slide is going to allow you to send in questions. Anyone is welcome to use that orange question mark button at any time throughout today's presentation to send in a question or a comment. If you are having trouble with the CLUIN website, you may need to turn off pop-up blockers. As we move through the slides today, each of you in the audience are in control of your presentation. The slide number is listed in the upper left-hand corner, and the instructors are going to say that throughout the presentation today. We also, if you're using the CLUIN system, have a list of slide numbers along the left, and that's useful during the question and answer break. Perhaps if a question refers back to a previous slide, you can jump back and forward through the presentation. Our last slide includes a link to our feedback form, and we do ask that everyone on the call today take just a few minutes to give us your feedback. We do use the information and appreciate you taking a little time at the end of the class. Today's training is being recorded, and we offer archives of previous ITRC training classes, and I've listed the link on this slide. On slide 3, this is our disclaimer and copyright that we include in all ITRC training presentations and ask you please read over the slide. In short, it says we've tried to provide accurate and reliable information, but do not warranty this material. We recommend you check with local, state, federal laws, as well as experts. ITRC does not endorse any specific products. ITRC's presentations and documents are copyrighted, so please ask permission before using. On slide 4, this is some information about ITRC, and I encourage you to go to the ITRC website to learn more about products that are available and other ways you can become involved in ITRC. ITRC is hosted by the Environmental Council of States, and overall, ITRC is a network that's led by state regulators. It includes federal partners, Department of Energy, Defense, and the Environmental Protection Agency, as well as members from industry, academia, and community stakeholders. This diverse group works together, and they address a topic. A topic could be a type of technology or type of site and contaminant. They communicate results through products, technical and regulatory guidance documents, and internet-based and classroom training. On slide 5, you can see some examples of topics that ITRC has addressed in the past. These are courses that we're offering in training classes in 2011. Along the left, you'll see the list of courses that we've offered previous years and we're continuing to offer. We also develop new courses each year, and along the right is a list of the new courses. ITRC also offers classroom training. We have a class on vapor intrusion pathway in July in Novi, Michigan. And we also are working on an LNAPL two-day classroom training and hope to have information available soon about locations for 2011. On slide 6, I'll introduce our instructors. All of our instructors were members of the ITRC Enhanced Attenuation of Chlorinated Organics team. Kimberly Wilson is a senior hydrogeologist at the South Carolina Department of Health and Environmental Control in Columbia. She oversees environmental remediation activities at nuclear waste disposal and post-closure RCRA sites. Kimberly is a team leader for the ITRC Enhanced Attenuation of Chlorinated Organics team. Richard Lewis is a principal engineer at HSA Engineers and Scientists, a member of the CRA family of companies in Fort Myers, Florida. He's been the project manager or lead technical advisor on HSA's contracts with Department of Energy, City of Fort Myers, City of Tampa, NASA, Intel, and the Florida Department of Environmental Protection. Dr. Guy Sewell is a professor of environmental health sciences at East Central University in Ada, Oklahoma. He is the executive director of the Institute for Environmental Science Education and Research. Previously, he was a research microbiologist with the U.S. EPA. If you move to slide 7, I'll now turn today's presentation over to Kimberly Wilson of the South Carolina Department of Health and Environmental Control. Kimberly?
Okay, good morning, everybody. Thank you very much, Juliana. And on slide 7, you'll see a course map of what we're going to cover today. This is the overview, and it shows the 7 basic information points that we will be touching on. Moving to slide 8, this is just an example of source removal, and I think most people would agree that source treatment or removal, the mass reduction, is key to total site rehabilitation. And looking at this particular example, it's a dry cleaning site in Florida, and they're doing excavation, but other source reduction technologies include soil vapor extraction, in situ bioremediation, dual phase extraction, co-solvent flushing, among others. Moving to slide 9, we have a graph showing concentration over time, and I think this is a fairly typical type scenario that you see. You have your high levels of PCE and TCE, and then you go in, you do your source reduction, you see a great drop off, and then you sort of plateau out there. And this seems to be typical. We see that at chlorinated sites with groundwater contamination. So during the course of the rest of the presentation, we're going to be providing information on how the enhanced evaluation, enhanced attenuation team evaluated the problem and developed the enhanced attenuation concept, the decision flow chart, and the technology toolbox. Moving to slide 10. Basically, we're just looking at I've moved too far along. Moving to slide 10, what prompted the team to come up with the concept of enhanced attenuation? Well, first of all, chlorinated organic contamination is everywhere. It's global. And at the time, there was little guidance available on when to transition from active remedies to less active remedies. So the development of applicable protocol and decision tools seemed like a good idea and where we could encourage innovative approaches to site closure and hopefully offer savings in cost, time, and risk. Moving to slide 11. Some of the challenges that we faced were limited efforts to understand limited understanding about the balance between source loading and attenuation capacity. And because of that, there were longer remediation time frames. There was also limited understanding at the time of site-specific natural attenuation processes. There was little guidance for when to transition, as I said earlier. And other challenges are that natural attenuation rates are or can be very slow. Moving to slide 12. One of the first things that the enhanced attenuation team did was send out a survey to state regulators, and we had a very good feedback on that. And as you can see from this, one conclusion that we were able to draw from the survey was that there was just not a lot of experience by regulators with using MNA at site and bringing them to closure. In fact, 54% of the respondents had no sites where they were using MNA with chlorinated organics. And so that was a major problem. Moving to slide 13, another part of the survey that we sent out was we asked them whether they were supportive of encouraging a phased MNA enhanced attenuation decision process. And as you can see from this, the majority of people were very supportive, were supportive, and few had no opinion, and there were one or two that just didn't think that it would work, so they were not supportive, but the majority were. Moving to slide 14, an important thing to note is that enhanced attenuation is consistent with monitored natural attenuation. It adds additional components, so it is not MNA. Key difference being that human intervention to boost naturally occurring processes is allowed and is encouraged. We have talked with John Wilson and with the EPA and ADA, and he is very supportive of this idea. He likes the idea, so we must be on to something. Anyway, as with MNA, with EA, you still have to have your comprehensive site characterization. You have to have an accurate site model, conceptual site model, and you have to have a good idea of what's going on there. We encourage innovative remedial designs that rely on sustainability, and we also encourage the use of mass flux evaluation, which we'll talk about later in the discussion. And as I said, it allows the use of human intervention. So moving to slide 15, this is just a diagram that shows that enhanced attenuation is the bridge between your aggressive source treatments and monitored natural attenuation. You're moving from very high energy solutions to lower energy or close to no energy solutions. It is a site management tool. Moving to slide 16. Some of the key concepts about enhanced attenuation is that it provides an organized, scientific, and structured approach to implement your treatment technologies, and it facilitates the transition of your site through the remediation process. It's something that allows you to bring all of your different parties involved online all together, and everybody can speak through it and see what's going on. I know here in South Carolina, our attorneys here at the agency really like it when we do this sort of thing, because we've got it documented that we've moved through this process, and this is why we did what we did when we did it. And so if something were to go to court, we've got it all right there and can document it. So that's a nice thing to have frequently. Moving to slide 17, a few more key concepts. It's a green approach. It encourages you to be use as little energy as possible. You're moving from the more aggressive to the less aggressive, and it's sustainable. So hopefully, as you move through, you're able to do fewer steps to get to that final closure. Now, there are different technologies that can be used to reduce source flux or to increase the attenuation capacity in the plume so that the plume will stabilize and start shrinking. The technologies designed, described in the TechReg guidance are not new. What's new is that it's a design approach. It's holistic. You're using the structured decision protocol. You're moving through the flow chart taking it step by step. Moving to slide 18, just a few definitions and general application we'll go through. For this course and for the enhanced attenuation concept, our definition of sustainable is, you can read it right there along with me, when physical, chemical, and biological mechanisms or processes continue over the lifespan of the remediation in a manner that the mass balance of the plume remediation favors plume reduction. Basically, we're just saying that any amendments that you add or that are there naturally occurring, that they last for the lifetime of the remediation or close to it, that you're not going to run out halfway through and have everything come to a complete halt. So moving to slide 19, continuing with our definitions, we have mass loading, and that is the mass of the material entering your air, entering an area per unit time from the source zone, but it also includes residual product that's carried into the plume. The attenuation capacity is the ability of the groundwater system to lower your contaminant concentrations along the aquifer. And mass balance is the quantitative estimate of mass loading to the dissolved plume from various sources compared to the mass attenuation capacity of the plume. So moving to slide 20, this is just a cartoon showing the idea of mass balance between your contaminant loading and your system capacity. You've got your source there, your red box, and then moving from your source into your aquifer, showing your dissolved plume. And your mass loading takes into account your flux, infiltration, and desorption. And you have to balance that out with your attenuation capacity, which includes biodegradation, abiotic degradation, adsorption onto your aquifer material, and then at the plume boundary, you're going to have advection and dispersion, volatilization, hopefully some plant uptake, that sort of thing. Moving to slide 21, this again is a cartoon, and it's just showing whether your plume is expanding, stable, shrinking, or exhausted, which is, of course, what we're ultimately working towards. Of course, your requirements for monitored natural attenuation include that the plume poses minimal risk, that it's stable or shrinking, so you want to have a figure like 2 or 3, and that you have a contingency plan with triggers identified so that you can move to that plan if it's needed. Moving to slide 22. This slide and the next one are good slides to discuss mass flux. And this diagram represents natural attenuation process with a constant source. And while it's not new to you, it's important to review the concept and then show you how the enhancements can help reduce the flux and concentrations along the flow line. So moving from your source, you have your flux moving in, and as you move through the aquifer, you're going to have some chemical attenuation, you're going to have sorption and abiotic degradation pulling some of your contamination off, you're going to have your physical attenuation such as dispersion, diffusion, advection. You're going to have your aerobic and anaerobic biological attenuation, and as you move farther down, then your concentrations are lessening because of all of those. And then you're going to reach your compliance point or compliance plane, and you're going to have established your maximum permissible flux or concentrations to meet regulatory requirements. Moving to slide 23, this slide shows how enhancements have an additive or supplemental effect on the natural attenuation processes and helping reduce mass flux beyond that which is generated without intervention. So the objective, of course, is to reduce mass flux to a level that is less than the attenuation capacity within the plume, allowing you to meet your maximum permissible concentrations or flux at your compliance plane. So if you reduce your source, you're reducing your flux into the plume, and you can see that by the dark red is smaller and you've got the shaded area showing what was originally entering in. And then as you move on through the aquifer, if you can increase your absorption or abiotic degradation, you're adding to that being pulled out, move along all the way through, and eventually, as you increase your arrows being pulled out, your arrow going towards your compliance plane is getting smaller as you move along, and like I say, hopefully allowing you to reach your maximum permissible levels. Moving to slide 24. This is just a continuum of remediation technologies, and it includes enhanced attenuation technologies before you actually reach MNA and closure. And you can see that on the left side of the slide, you have your more energy-intensive technologies, and as you move on through, you're getting to lesser energy consumption type technologies until MNA, where you're basically not using any energy other than for your monitoring. Moving to slide 25, some of the regulatory considerations that you have to look at with EA, as with any remedy selection, is what permits are needed. You're going to need to look at risk and take into account time and cost in the selection of your remedy. You need to balance your site characterization with cleanup in that consideration. Other considerations to look at are changes in geochemical conditions. If your amendments are going to be changing groundwater geochemistry, then you need to know what's down gradient and what water is used for down gradient and whether that's going to affect that use. So you'll be working with your regulators on that. As with all corrective actions, of course, you have to have a contingency plan. What if this doesn't work? And then you can move forward. You should also have triggers identified so that you know when to implement your contingency plan, when you know that something is not working. We like to use mass flux measurements, but you have to remember that it does not replace concentration-based measures, since just about every state has concentration-based measures for meeting regulatory limits. And institutional controls generally are part of MNA, and that needs to be discussed with your regulator, and that's going to vary from state to state and site to site. Moving to slide 26, looking at the benefits of enhanced attenuation. Well, the biggest one is it helps you move or transition your site through the remediation process, and it provides scientific documentation for changing remedies as you move along. Like I said, our lawyers in South Carolina love that because you can show why you did what you did when you did it. Enhanced attenuation also complements monitored natural attenuation and expands your remediation opportunities. Basically, it's a tailored intervention approach that is site-specific. Moving to slide 27, additional benefits include that you can integrate your source zone treatment with your plume treatment and MNA. It complies with existing environmental regulations. Nothing new is added or needed. And it encourages a systematic approach to total site remediation and allows you to get all interested parties on board and working together. And it's site-specific, which is also a benefit, so that's always good. Moving to slide 28. So we have covered all of this, and I guess now we are going to open it up for questions and answers.
Thank you, Kimberly. On slide 29, we have a slide for questions and answers. For our phone line audience, you're welcome to ask questions out loud. You need to unmute at your location as well as select *6 to unmute using our system. That's *6 to unmute using our system. And when you ask a question, please state your name and location. For our simulcast participants, it's the orange question mark button at the top of the slide that's going to allow you to send in questions. Do we have questions to start from our phone line audience? I'll also remind you at this point, in the next section of the training, we're going to refer to a decision flowchart, and we provided that originally when we sent your registration confirmation as an attachment. It's also available on the training website for today. That was in your confirmation email, the page you started at. In the presentation overview in that last paragraph, we included a link to the one-page version of the PDF. It's also, if you've downloaded our associated document for today's training, it's figure 2-1 on page 10. Of that document. In the next section of the training, we're going to walk through that decision flowchart, and it's useful for you to have a one-page version of that to follow along. For our phone line audience, remember to unmute your phone, both at your location and by selecting *6. It does take a minute or two for our simulcast questions to come through. While we're waiting, Kimberly, can you tell us more about the other ITRC project that you're working on?
Well, I am working with the Permeable Reactive Barrier Technology Update team, and we are in the final days of finishing up our technical regulatory document. Hopefully that will be going to press next week, and then we're working on an internet-based training for that class, for that course also, and that will be offered in July. And we're updating previous ITRC documents and presenting new information on PRBs that we hope will be useful.
We have a simulcast question from Wally Castile at Green Oak Consulting in Kentucky. And this is for Kimberly. Based on your experience, what percentage of sites that you see in your office meet the standards for an optimum site conceptual model? 100%, 50%, 10%? In your estimation, what are the weak points in the site characterization approach?
Wow. I would say that the majority of my sites do have good site characterization and site conceptual models, but it's not it's a work in progress. You know, something comes in and we think we've got it worked out, but as we move along through the process, we realize that we can keep refining. But I think overall most sites have a good idea of what's going on at this point. Maybe not initially, but at this point. And I'm sorry, what was the second part of the question?
What are the weak points in the site characterization approach?
Well, I guess weakest point is that you don't know everything before you start your remediation, and that your remediation continues to add to it, which means what you start with may not be best for your site, but at the time you thought it was. So it's an iterative process.
We have a comment from Zuhar Ramo, who works for the state of Georgia in Atlanta. I see that EA benefits also reducing the time for the remediation process. This is an important factor for large plumes.
And that is. I mean, even with small plumes, it's an important factor.
Thank you. We'll go ahead and wrap up this question and answer break. If you have taken your phone off of mute, it's *6 to toggle back onto mute. And so we do ask that you be sure to double check that your phone is on mute so that we don't pick up any background noise. We're going to continue on with the next section in today's training class. We'll move to slide 30. And I will now turn today's presentation over to Richard Lewis with HSA Engineers and Scientists, a member of the CRA family of companies. Richard?
Thanks very much, Juliana. I'm going to take us from slide 30. We're going to discuss the fifth of these seven basic points that are outlined here in our presentation. And specifically, I'm going to take you through the decision flow chart. On slide 31, here's where we talk about the goals of the flowchart. Simply put, the framework provides a roadmap for decision making, and it allows you to translate from active remediation to a sustainable solution, like natural attenuation, enhanced attenuation, or closure for that matter. Basically, the framework can be used to determine when to stop operation of an active remedy and to transition to some other appropriate EA or M&A remedy, and this is considered both for the source area and for different areas of the plume. And one of the key aspects of this decision process is that it needs to be sustainable, and you'll find this concept of sustainability throughout the discussion of EA. Now, in many regulatory frameworks that exist, there's nothing that provides this mechanism to transition from active remediation to M&A, or for that matter, to act as a framework for optimization throughout the regulatory process. And importantly, there's also nothing in those regulatory frameworks that precludes this optimization or decisions about when to transfer from active remediation to M&A. And this framework fills that gap. And importantly, and Kimberly discussed this earlier, this framework does not replace any existing laws or regulations, provides this innovative way to work within the existing laws and regulations. And then finally, the framework is scientifically defensible, and it provides a documented methodology for implementation for the regulators. And and it also incorporates the innovative and optimized solutions that are cost-effective, efficient, and safe. Now, on slide 32, we can see the flowchart itself, and this is the decision framework. In the following slides, we'll go through the flowchart, and this is available in Appendix C of the guidance, and as Juliana said, it's been sent out, and this would be the point at which you want to get that copy out. It's also available on the website, as has been discussed earlier. Okay, now moving to slide 33, you can see a simplified version of the flowchart. Up at the top, in that blue rectangle, we talk about source treatment through active remediation. Now, source remediation is something that we've all done for many years, and I think we're all fairly comfortable in this box. In EA, one of the keys is not just looking at active remediation in and of itself, but considering it in a more holistic way by considering a treatment train approach and what will happen in the future with sequential implementation of a particular remedial strategy, considering both the source and the plume together. Maybe asking yourself the question, how might something that we do in the source area affect the rest of the plume? Now, in the second blue box, this is concerned with collecting data and evaluating data for potential risks at the site and understanding plume stability. Is the plume stable? Is it expanding? Is it contracting? This will be a key part of the decision-making process. Now, in order to transition from active remediation to M&A or EA, we need to answer a series of questions. And these are provided in the vertical green and yellow rectangles. And these boxes, we'll discuss these in particular, but there are a series of yes or no questions that will help us determine whether M&A or EA is appropriate. In addition, and this is important, there are feedback loops that depend on the answers to a number of these questions, and they provide opportunities for optimizations that take you through different points in the chart depending on the answers to those questions. Let's say we have a certain path that we selected, or remedial option that we selected, but in fact we don't accomplish some of the milestones that are set forth, or we've set out on EA, but we don't meet some milestones that we set out. This framework provides an opportunity to move back through and evaluate that process. Moving to slide 34, now, on this slide, generally, as part of most regulatory frameworks, you'll find some level of source or plume treatment that's required. Again, this is a process with which most of us are familiar. Now, in terms of active remediation, we're usually thinking in terms of high-energy, high-intensity activities, an excavation, or a remedial system that requires maintenance on a regular basis. The EA framework formalizes this process by adding the requirement for integrating the source remedy into what's happening in the rest of the plume, or, for that matter, the next phase of remediation. Let's stop and think of an example. One might consider using chemical oxidation in a source area for chlorinated solvents. If the initial oxidation reduction potential is quite low, the question needs to be asked, how might this remedial action affect the plume in terms of reductive dehalogenation after the chemical oxidation? Now, some folks have thought in the past that by changing to an oxidizing environment, that reductive dehalogenation would be permanently disrupted, and this appears not to be the case. But it's certainly something that needs to be considered when implementing a treatment option in one portion of the plume, how it might affect other portions of the plume down gradient, and how it might affect that area in the future when you come back if there's a treatment train approach that's required. On slide 35, when you're considering or evaluating plume stability, the current data set can be used to estimate the long-term stability of the contaminated area. And one of the key elements here, and this is just absolutely essential for transitioning to either M&A or EA, is that the plume at the compliance point is stable or shrinking. And this is defined in the guidance, and we can just read it right off the slide here. Plume stability occurs when the perimeter of the plume attains sufficient size or location such that attenuation mechanisms equal or exceed the mass at the boundary. Now, another way of saying that is that the mass flux from the source must be less than or equal to the attenuation capacity of the aquifer, and that the system doesn't change in the future such that this balance is disrupted. Now, on slide 36, we see a graphic describing the sources and sinks of mass flux, and the balance of these is needed for long-term stability. A dissolved plume is shown here in yellow, emanating from a source area in red, and some of the inputs are listed in the red to yellow box there. Flow through the source, infiltration, desorption, and these could lead to a dissolved phase plume. The sinks are listed also biodegradation, abiotic degradation, adsorption. And then at the plume boundary, the mechanisms are dilution, advection, dispersion, and you may have some volatilization or some plant uptake as well. Now, traditionally, regulators have solely required the comparison of concentration data to regulatory standards as opposed to the evaluation of mass flow or mass flux. Specifically, they're looking at mass, chemical mass, per unit volume, instead of mass per unit time. Now, on the other hand, dose and risk assessment, on which we base the concentration-based regulatory values, they consider the latter, mass per unit time. So consideration of a concentration-based regulatory framework is typically required by law under most jurisdictions, and what we're doing here under EA doesn't change any of that. Instead, EA adds this new tool, which considers more than just concentrations. Mass balance evaluation is also considered. On slide 37, as part of that evaluation, the next step is to go through each diamond and answer the questions. The first question, and here it's listed, are the risks acceptable? And what this means is, under the current scenario, is there anything that would preclude the use of EA or M&A, such as the existence of an unacceptable residual risk due to the location of the plume, vapor intrusion, something along those lines? If the answer to this question is no, it may be appropriate to look at EA and not move to M&A. All right. If the answer, on the other hand, is yes, one can proceed down the flow chart, and we can proceed to slide 38 to determine, using the data that we analyzed in the rectangle above, if the plume is stable or shrinking. Now, if the answer is no, well, M&A is not appropriate, and we need to consider EA. We need to proceed in another direction. On the other hand, if the answer is yes, and there's regulatory concurrence, we can move to the next diamond, which is shown on slide 39. Now, here we're attempting to demonstrate sustainability of the system. Will the current system that results in plume stability exist in the future? If they're not sustainable in the future, EA may provide technologies that are sustainable and at the same time low impact and low energy. On the other hand, if the answer is yes, and the system's already sustainable, M&A may be appropriate. It's probably a good idea to stop here again and have another example. Let's say you have a landfill site that has been impacted by both chlorinated solvents and petroleum products. It may very well be the case that currently the chlorinated solvents are being effectively degraded by reductive dehalogenation. However, once the petroleum products, which are acting as an electron donor in the current scenario, once they're consumed, there may no longer be a sufficient source of electrons for reductive dehalogenation to balance the flux of solvent, chlorinated solvent, from the source. So, although it's currently the case that there's stability, in the future, it might not be the case. On slide 40, we're looking at the remediation time frame. This is a decision for the responsible parties and folks like the regulated entity, the regulator, and other stakeholders. And the stakeholders, all these stakeholders together, need to determine what's the appropriate time frame for remediation. If the time frame with no augmentation or enhancement is acceptable, then enhanced attenuation can be considered. If, on the other hand, the time frame, if it's not acceptable, EA can be considered. If, on the other hand, the time frame is acceptable under M&A, then you can continue to move down the chart. But this input on this particular issue is key to get it from all the key parties and stakeholders. All right, on slide 41, the costs and benefits are weighed. If the cost of implementing an M&A strategy are unacceptable, EA would be considered. On the other hand, if they are acceptable, we continue down the flowchart. And consideration of costs and benefits is very important. Many states, in fact, have specific requirements aimed at balancing these factors. The desire for a faster cleanup, even at greater cost, might be driven by the need to mitigate unacceptable risks or by community or political involvement. Some of the key cost-benefit considerations are listed here: the time frame, ability to achieve the regulatory or performance goals, cost-effectiveness, and to name a few that are listed there. On slide 42, if all five questions were answered yes, then M&A is appropriate, and the flowchart provides a step-by-step mechanism to lead you to that determination. That being said, the framework allows for movement back up the flowchart if, in the future, conditions change or assumptions that were made in the process are found to be incorrect. Contingency plans or milestone goals can be used to assess the continued success of M&A or whether you're meeting closure goals. And if the milestones are met, then you continue on until you reach closure. Or if they're not met, you can return to the up the flow chart. And that's contemplated by these highlighted lines that allow you to move up the flow chart. So if back to the rectangles, if any question happened to be answered no, then EA or a return to active remediation is considered. So we're going to step over to slide 43. And to arrive here, there's had to be a no response, and obviously a no response was received in the previous box, and that results in a recommendation to consider EA. And as Kimberly shared with us earlier, enhanced attenuation is this bridge between active remediation and M&A or EA, and it provides a mechanism to determine when active remediation stops and M&A or EA or closure is appropriate. Importantly, and for this to be the case, the plume must be sustainably stable or shrinking, which means that the flux from the source is equal to or less than the attenuation capacity of the aquifer. And we've got to help make this more straightforward, we have a case study coming up in the next section where we'll try to provide some specific details about how EA can be implemented. Now, on slide 44, enhancements could be considered for the source zone, and they're provided here. Reduction of the flux from the source area is the primary concern here. Periodic nutrient injection or the use of a permeable reactive barrier would be considered. In addition, methods of reducing infiltration through the source area would be analyzed, namely capping or constructing an upgrading cutoff wall or intercepting surface water flow or maybe even changing the permeability of the aquifer in the area where the contaminant existed, making the mass less accessible in that for transport in that area. As an example, perhaps the site contains PCBs, for which really direct exposure is the main concern. In addition, PCBs could be mobilized to groundwater on colloids by infiltrating rainwater. Now, once you had sufficient assessment and analysis, once that had been accomplished, it may be the case that the area could be capped with an impermeable surface, thereby reducing the potential for either direct exposure or transport to groundwater. Now, importantly, and this is an interesting consequence of moving to the strategy, the monitoring requirements, and this is, again, once sufficient data were obtained to support the decision, the monitoring requirements could shift from monitoring soil or groundwater to monitoring the presence and condition of the impermeable surface. Hence, one of the advantages of EA could be the potential shift of the monitoring requirements, including not only monitoring frequency, but what is actually monitored. All right, on slide 45, EA alternatives within the plume are illustrated. The key issues in this portion of the plume it would be increasing the attenuation capacity of the aquifer. Technologies such as nutrient injection, permeable reactive barriers that were considered in the source zone would also be considered here. Again, on slide 46, we see EA alternatives near the discharge point. And some of the same technologies that were considered or that were available to us in the upgraded portion of the plume are available here, along with the use of constructed wetlands and potentially even in-stream treatment. And although this was by far the least popular alternative in the regulatory survey that was presented earlier, some jurisdictions would consider volatilization as a sustainable alternative. All right. We arrive at slide 47, and we see the entire flowchart. From the orange shapes that consider EA If the answer were no to EA, there is no sustainable alternative, then you move back up to the top of the chart to consider active source or plume remediation, and this is in that blue rectangle one. On the other hand, if a yes response is obtained, then enhancements should be implemented and monitored. At the completion, after this has occurred, at the completion of EA, plume stability can again be examined and the process is repeated. And this takes you to, the arrow takes you to the blue rectangle number two. You'll notice that there's a feedback loop once you've reached M&A down at the bottom. After M&A is implemented, assuming that you work your way back through and reach M&A, after M&A is implemented, either closure is achieved or the milestones are not met. If milestones, and these are set out as part of the regulatory process, were not met, perhaps because of some of the assumptions, they just weren't accurate. The flowchart allows a feedback loop that leads us back up to the real evaluation of plume stability, and that, again, is in blue rectangle number two, which takes us back through the process. Now, taking a step back, we recognize that blue rectangle at the top is really just traditional EPA guidance for source treatment. And the green circles and yellow diamonds are based on the EPA guidance for M&A, although we did add an extra element to consider sustainability. That is new. Now, furthermore, although the combination of the existing EPA guidance is new, the chart is composed of only one truly new section, and that is this EA section in orange. Our next presenter is Dr. Guy Sewell from East Central University, and Guy will answer the question for us, why would you select EA as an option for a site? And then he'll take us through a case study to help make more concrete this EA concept. Guy?
Thanks, Richard. Good morning, everybody. We're on slide 48, and here again you're going to see the overview of the presentation. As we've moved through this presentation, we're going to discuss the seven basic information points that are outlined there for the eco training. Now, in this section, we're going to discuss those last two points. We're going to talk about the general application of the EA process and the use of the flowchart, and we're also going to explore an applied case study. Okay, so if we'll follow along to 49, so you may be asking yourself, you know, why should I use the EA flowchart? What are the advantages? Well, we feel that the appropriate use of the EA flowchart complements both source zone treatment and M&A by integrating them. And this integration, they're connecting these two processes, not only in the field, but in the management of the site, is kind of critical to success. Now, we also feel it helps to expand the regulatory paradigm while still complying with existing environmental regulations. And it provides a defined methodology for transitioning a site through the regulatory process. And this is important because both sides of the table can talk to each other, and we know, you know, what we're discussing. We have a common framework for decision-making and discussion. And we feel the use of the flowchart allows for a systematic evaluation of enhancement technologies or combinations of technologies, such as an integrated phased approach. And it allows us to ask those what-if questions. Now, finally, this can enhance your remedial efficiency by developing optimal solutions for each site, by tailoring to site-specific conditions and to site-specific remedial objectives. So, in all, we feel that the EA flowchart provides a flexible site management tool to respond to changes in performance, costs, risks, risk reduction goals, and the flowchart can be used both proactively and reactively. Okay, so let's go on to slide 50. Now, once again, we need to be clear that the use of the EA flowchart and the eco process is a site management tool. It's not a remedial technology. And indeed, the flowchart can incorporate all existing technologies and even new remedial technologies that we're sure will be developed in the future. So the flowchart and the process allows for the incorporation of a wide variety of diverse primary and secondary remedial options that fit a site's regulatory performance and cost goals. And it allows us to address site management challenges such as hotspots or variable exposure paths or multiple future use scenarios. And you'll notice on this slide, that the ITRC offers more detailed guidance in the use of many other enhancement technology or many enhancement technologies, and those are designated by the red asterisks. Okay, so let's go on to 51. But as we're using the EA process and the flowchart, it does require that for each option or a combination of options that we're considering be evaluated in the context of the ongoing and planned remedial activities, and then, if acceptable, implemented and monitored in a manner that's consistent with the site's remedial goals and consistent with ongoing site remedial evaluation in the EA flowchart. So we have to ask ourselves each time as we implement and to the whatever extent possible as we evaluate enhancements. Are they sustainable? Do they achieve mass loading reductions? Is the attenuation capacity increased? Are they still protective of human health and the environment? Is the enhancement appropriate in the context of the current remedial response? And will the regulatory milestones still be achieved? Okay, so let's go on to 52. Now, this slide's an overview of the steps in the implementation of the EA flowchart. Let's go through them again just to refresh our memory. Step one is the baseline characterization, including the mass balance assessment to characterize plume stability and to provide a baseline for evaluating the remedial response. Step two is the source zone treatment, typically using active remedial technologies and perhaps MNA for the downgrade portion of dissolved plume if it's appropriate. Step three is the utilization of flowchart to implement MNA for the downgradient plume after the active treatment phase has resulted in substantial reductions in contaminant loading from the source zone, or to evaluate enhancements as needed and appropriate. Step four is an enhancement is implemented to increase the rate of mass attenuation of dissolved plume to accelerate the achievement of compliance within the site cleanup criteria. And step five, after the enhancements result in a sustained increase in mass attenuation rates of dissolved plume, MNA is continued as a remedy for the dissolved plume, and hopefully we get to step six where we achieve site closure. Okay, so let's go on here. Now on to slide 53. So let's consider a hypothetical site. All right, so at our site, we're going to say we have a confined aquifer with interbedded lenses of finer material, high concentration source of TCE and BTEX in the saturated zone, with negligible contributions from the beta zone. So we have a dissolved plume of PCE, DCE, bond chloride, and BTEX. We have naturally anaerobic conditions, and some natural attenuation is occurring because of the anthropogenic electron donor, the BTEX, and perhaps native organic matter that's also a source of electron donor. And so we're seeing reductive dechlorination. And we'll say the plume's relatively young and perhaps insufficient time-limited data are available for directly evaluating plume stability, and so we're going to work toward that. And let's just say for this scenario that no potential receptors are on site, although there could be exposure points downgraded. Okay? All right, so that's rather typical scenario here. All right, so let's go on to the next slide. So here's our baseline assessment figure. So we're going to think about the source. We're going to think about the dissolved plume. Now, in step one, we need to evaluate the loading and attenuation capacity. So let's look at our two boxes there. So on the loading side, we assess the source flux and evaluate the impact of infiltration, adsorption, if they're appropriate. And we're going to try to determine the attenuation capacity on the right-hand box. So we're going to assess things like biological and abiotic transformations as well as adsorption. And we might evaluate the impact of advection, dispersion, volatilization, uptake, again, if they're appropriate to the site. Okay, so a little bit of baseline there. Let's go on to the next slide. Now, we've seen this before. This is our kind of cartoon of the potential dynamics of mass loading versus the attenuation capacity. So let's consider, again, those potential outcomes. Now, in the first example, on the left-hand side, we have loading that exceeds attenuation capacity, so we have an expanding plume. In the second example, we have mass loading and attenuation capacity at approximately equal rates, and so we're seeing a stable plume. In the third example, the attenuation capacity exceeds the loading process, so we see a shrinking plume. And the final example is meant to be where the source zone has been removed, and we're seeing basically an exhausted plume. Okay, so with that refreshing of our memory, let's go on to the next slide. Now, on slide 56, we're back to our plume dynamic cartoon. And let's say we conduct our baseline assessment and get the following results. All right, on the loading side, we see mobilization from the source resulting, say, 10,000 kilograms of contamination a year entering the dissolve phase. And on the attenuation side, we've got mechanisms such as biodegradation adsorption. Let's say that removes about 5,500 kilograms a year from the dissolve phase. So in this hypothetical example, we're thinking back to the previous slide, we have loading that exceeds the attenuation capacity, and we have an expanding plume. Okay, so common scenario. So let's say now we have this basic understanding of the site. How do we implement the flow chart? So let's go on to the next slide, on slide 57. Remember, we're doing our step one, our baseline assessment, and it's yielded the need for a level one response, because an untreated or expanding plume indicates that source zone and or primary plume treatment is required. Okay, so as back on slide 52, at step two, as shown in this slide, a source zone treatment is conducted at our site. Okay, so let's go on and evaluate the site again. Let's go to the next slide, on slide 58. Okay, we've done some sort of source zone treatment. Now we're in the post-source zone treatment phase, and let's assume that after that treatment, the attenuation capacity now exceeds the loading, and this results in a shrinking plume. Okay, so we're in that second potential figure from our cartoon earlier. So now, can we transition into MNA? Well, maybe. But in step three, we're going to use the EA flow chart and proceed with a level two evaluation of plume stability and sustainability. That's that second blue box. And assume in this example that the compliance point in our diagram up here represents a potential receptor or property boundary. Now, the attenuation capacity exceeds the loading, and we achieve a shrinking plume. But as we go through our decision-making process on the flowchart, let's go on to the next slide, slide 60. As we're using the flowchart in our level two evaluations of stability and sustainability, we're using our decision points, which are those green circles. And in this case, we might pass through our level two evaluations at decision points, perhaps at B, C, D, and E, but we might fail at decision point A. Are the risks acceptable? Because remember, the downgrading property owner may think the risks are unacceptable, or that may be an exposure point that kicks up the risks of the site to unacceptable levels. Okay, so risk from elevated concentration at the receptor or to the down path property owner unacceptable at the site. So following the chart, we're kicked to the right, okay, and we would then consider enhancements and evaluate their potential to meet our site-specific management and performance goals. Okay, so let's go on to slide 60. Okay, and now we're going to conduct that level two evaluation. That's the first orange box of enhancements and or combinations of enhancements needed to meet our performance goals. But remember, as we go through these enhancements, as we consider these enhancements or combinations of enhancements, we still have to make sure that we, you know, look at sustainability, mass loading reductions or increased attenuation capacity. They still have to be protective of human health and the environment. The remedy has to be appropriate and compatible with the ongoing and past remedial activities at the site. And the regulatory milestones and site-specific conditions have to be addressed in this decision process. Okay. All right, so in step four, let's say in step four we select and implement and, of course, continuously assess our selected enhancement. So let's go on with our hypothetical scenario and go to slide 61. So in this step four, post-enhancement, the plume reaches a new equilibrium. okay? And let's say in this case, the attenuation capacity now appears to be equivalent to loading, and so we've got a stable plume with acceptable concentrations at the compliance point. Now, can we transition to M&A? Well, maybe. So we have to proceed through another level two evaluation of plume stability and sustainability following along the flow chart. So let's go back to the flow chart. Let's look at slide 62, okay? And remember, in step three, we used the flow chart to evaluate and select an enhancement. And in step four, we implemented and monitored the enhancement. Now we're back to conducting another level two evaluation of plume stability following along in the flow chart. And in this case, based on the information in the previous slide, we passed through our level two evaluation at all those decision points, risk, performance, conditions are acceptable, time, and cost. And so the attenuation capacity appears to be sustainable. The time frame is acceptable. Cost benefits are acceptable. And we can now proceed to step five and select M&A if it's needed and continuously evaluate the performance until the remedial goals are met. And then hopefully we proceed to step six and closure is achieved. But remember, through the use of the EA flowcharts and its continuous reevaluation of performance, we always retain the option to change the remedial process if conditions or information or site management goals change in the future before we achieve closure. Okay? And the true value of the framework. Okay. So let's go to our course map on slide 63. And now we're going to get to the point where we're going to provide a case study example. All right. Okay. Let's go to 64. Now, we were going to use a Florida dry cleaner. It was operated for 8 years, okay, through the mid-1990s, located in a strip mall. There's no current receptors, although there are well fields within a mile. The assessment was completed in 1998. There's a Dean Apple present to the top of the clay layer, confining clay layer, a plume over 100 feet emanating under the building. So, pretty common dry cleaner scenario, okay? Now, this site was not managed with the EA process or the EA flowchart, but we can still use it as an example. And when we do this, we demonstrate the value of the flowchart and the process to existing sites. So, this flowchart's a valuable site management tool regardless of the life cycle position or the status of your site of concern. Okay. Well, let's go on to slide 65 and get some more information. So we've got a 5-foot unsaturated zone. We've got silty sand to 20 feet below land surface that fines down. Underlying clay layer. We've got a K value about 10 feet per day and a relatively flat gradient of 0.003. And no contamination was detected below the clay layer. Okay? All right, now let's go on and look at a map of the site. Let's go to slide 66. Okay, now we're at step one in the use of the EA process. So we're doing our baseline characterization of the site. So in this case, if you'll look at the map, you'll see that the dry cleaner is defined by the yellow box. Okay, the light blue is a lower concentration plume, and the darker blue is a higher concentration area, and regional flow is toward the northeast. Now, we see here that typical dual plume that we often find with dry cleaners because there's multiple release points. And in this case, we'll note that the plume was expanding and moving off-site. Okay, so we can see as we're hitting the road out there. Okay, so note the location of DW2 and monitoring well 3. We're going to use those as we go along here. Okay? All right, so... An untreated or expanding plume, okay, and that's what we have here, it requires a level one response, and that's what we got. We got source zone treatment at this site. So a dual-phase extraction system and a box design was used to dewater mobilize and extract contamination from below the dry cleaner, and they removed about 250 pounds of PCE. Okay? All right, so now let's use our EA flowchart to further manage the site. So let's go to the next slide on 68. After the source zone treatment, you know, we do a level two evaluation of plume stability and sustainability. And at this point, we're going to assess the decision points, you know, risks, stability, sustainability, time frame, and cost. So let's consider some performance data from the site and see how we would work through those decision points, okay? All right, let's go on to slide 69. Okay, here's our map again, showing regional groundwater flow, and note the location again of monitoring well DWO2. Now, soil cores from this area were very high, okay? So you got everybody has a figure in their mind. Let's switch over to slide 70, and let's evaluate the concentration in DWO2 post-source zone treatment, and we can see that loading to the mobile phase appears to be relatively stable, but it's at unacceptable levels. Got a log scale there. Focus on that. And we're really talking about things to the left of the black bar here, so don't pay attention to the right. Okay, so we see some impact from the source zone treatment in the dissolve phase, but probably still at unacceptable levels, or at least levels that would impact our decision-making process. Okay, so let's use the flowchart to evaluate this data after the fact and see what we would have done. Okay, on slide 71, we're still in step three. We're conducting that level two evaluation of plume stability and sustainability. All right, now, in this case, we might pass through our decision points in our level two evaluations, perhaps say, A, which risks, B, stability, C, sustainability, E, cost. But let's say we fail at decision point D because the concentrations are still relatively high, and if we didn't do anything else, we're looking at an extremely long lifetime for this site. So we're going to say the remedial time frames are unacceptable because of the higher concentrations in dissolve phase. Okay, so now what that does is we made that decision. We've failed at a decision point. We're kicked to the right, and we're going to go through our consideration of enhancements and their potential to meet, you know, the site-specific management and performance goals. Okay, so let's look at slide 72. So continuing step three, we evaluate the enhancements and combinations of enhancements needed to meet our goals. Okay, but, you know, we're still going to keep in mind all those important considerations, sustainability, okay, mass loading reductions or increased attenuation capacity, protective of human health and the environment, appropriate and compatible with ongoing and past remedial activities at the site, and are we still meeting regulatory milestones and addressing site-specific conditions, okay? All right, so in our decision process here, okay, now we're going to go on to slide 73. So let's say, actually at the site, after an evaluation, an enhancement was selected. Again, you know, this is after the fact, but we could have made that. We would have come to the same decision with the use of the EA process. Now, at this particular site, a biostimulation, bioaugmentation enhancement was chosen and implemented and monitored. So lactate, nutrients, deethanogenase was added, okay, and it looks pretty good. Okay, so now let's look at some site data. Let's go on to the next slide, 74. Let's look at our map again. And in this point now, we need to pay attention to the location of well DWO2 that we noticed before, but the downgradient monitoring well MW3, okay? All right, so we got that. Now let's look at some data. Okay, so now on our performance data from concentration data from well MW3 and the downgradient well, we see concentrations before the multi-phase extraction system was implemented. That'd be the first bar in June of 2001. And we see data before and after the implementation of the enhancement, the December 2004 bio pilot study. And if we'll look at the data set, we see what looks like some significant changes after our enhancement was implemented there. So, again, a log scale, and if you want to look at the magenta line, which has the X's on it, that kind of represents a molar concentration of all the daughters. So that kind of gives us a good feel of actual risk reduction versus transformations that are occurring at the site. Okay, and remember, log scale. Okay, looks good, looks pretty good. Okay, but let's look at that data in a slightly different way. So let's go on to the next slide. Let's look at slide 76. And let's look at it in a table form. Okay, and if we look at the concentration data, the breakdown of the individual daughter products, we see results that seem to support significant mass removal. Okay, now the two important events at the site are the ones are right before the lines in red. Remember, we had the dual phase extraction system in June of 2001, and then we had the biopilot study in December of 2004. And so the two lines immediately after those events, the two rows, in the table, we can see those are in red to highlight the significant changes in both the concentration profiles and concentration and the masses that they represent at the site. Okay. All right. So again, looks pretty good. Well, how does that impact our decision-making process? Okay. Well, let's try to use the EA flowchart to do our evaluation of our enhancement. Okay, so let's go on to slide 77, and let's do some simple flux estimates, okay? So if we look at the high concentration plume, you know, it's about 60 feet wide, and remember we've got a saturated thickness of about 15 feet, and if we just say that whole thing is at the high concentration, and then we back into our velocity measurements, we come up with a flux planes that are defined by the center point wells of those two systems. Now, again, we use a point in the center and extrapolate that high concentration over the entire plane. Okay? All right. If we do that, what does that give us? All right. Let's go on to slide 78. So we're going to do these simple flux estimates based on our planes that we've defined there. Now, based on our calculations, we see a flow of approximately 300,000 liters per year through the two planes. Okay? And we can calculate a flux through those of chloroethanes through those two planes. The source area plane, DW2 plane, of about something on the order of 1.4 kilograms per year. And through the downgradient MW3 plane, pre and post bio. And we get a couple of different numbers there. So we get about 0.045 kilograms per year pre-bio and 0.01 kilograms per year post-bio. Okay. Well, let's take that back to our site conceptual model. Okay. So let's go on to slide 79. And in this case, we represent the post source zone treatment, but pre-bio. And our two flux planes are represented on our diagram here. And we say, you know, is the plume shrinking? Well, let's do our mass loading considerations. Now, if we use the flux through DW2 plane as our loading, okay, and compare it to the difference to the loading at the MW3 plane, that tells us something about the attenuation capacity. Now, that attenuation capacity in this particular case is reduced to the zone or the time span or the area or volume between those two planes. But let's go ahead and work with that. And if we look at that pre-loading, we see, again, about 1.4 kilograms per year loading our system, and then looking at the changes then with what's actually passing through the down-gradient plane, we see an attenuation capacity that's to account for the lost mass of about 1.355 kilograms per year. So significant attenuation between those two points. All right, so let's go on to the next slide, and let's look at that same conceptual model, but now let's look at it post-biotreatment. Okay, so what has our enhancement done? Okay, so we see an increase in attenuation capacity from about 1.355 to 1.390 kilograms per year if we look at the differential between the loading and the down-gradient planes. Okay, so remember, this is really the simplest form of a flux measurement. Okay, and you know, I hope it gives everybody confidence to at least start trying to do this. Okay, and again, we're applying the concentration of a single point at that high concentration, we assume, over the entire extent of that plane for the flux calculation. Now, you might consider here for a second, this really shows the value of additional site characterization. Because if I had more points, in all probability, I would see lower concentrations away from the heart of the plume, and we would see a differential in the amount of loading and attenuation capacity. So the value of those additional monitoring points could be significant, and you might try putting in a pencil to that sometime. Okay, so we've got our information now. Let's go use the flowchart. So let's go to slide 81, okay? So we're going to, again, conduct that level 2 evaluation of plume stability and sustainability after our bioenhancement. Now, in this case, you know, we're currently conducting our level 2 evaluation in real time at the site, A, B, C, D, and E for, again, risk, stability, sustainability, and performance. And we, at this point, we may select M&A and continuously evaluate the performance until the site remedial goals are met, because we're seeing significant change out there. However, if MW3 is a compliance point, again, you know, our down gradient plane, you know, again, perhaps risk and even stability are both questionable, because that's all the data we have. And we should be considering additional enhancements or additional performance data, okay? Now, if we did select an additional enhancement, we would reevaluate and use the flowchart with its continuous reevaluation performance, okay? And we always retain the option of changing the remedial process if the conditions, if the conditions at the site or the information from the site or the site management goals change anytime in the future before we close it. And at this particular site, and what really happened, again, was that the same conclusion was come to in a more traditional site management approach, and they decided, yes, we still needed additional enhancement and an emulsified oil enhancement to bump up the bio activity was actually implemented and seems to be working pretty well at the site. Okay, so that's what really happened. You know, we marched along in our flow chart and basically remanaged the site considerations and options and the process, you know, after the fact, okay? But it worked out pretty well, and we came to the same decision points and perhaps in a more predictable and justifiable manner. Okay, so let's go to the next slide. So what's the future site? Actually, enhancements continue at the site and ultimately probably a shift of M&A. However, at any point in this process, the performance or the conditions are not acceptable. You know, you can always kick to the right from those decision points, do another level 3 evaluation of an additional set of enhancements. And if the performance or conditions are acceptable, you know, we may transition on to M&A, but we still have that continuous feedback and reevaluation loop. Okay? So that gives us that option to look at performance in a structured and predictable manner and to make decisions about whether or not we find the process acceptable now and even in the future if something changes. Okay? All right. Good. So if site management goals change, information change, conditions change, we have those options to make decisions about the best way to proceed with the management of the site. Okay, so let's go to my last slide, okay? And regardless of the choice we make, we can use that flowchart and the EA process to continuously reevaluate the performance of a site till it's closed. And it gives us all of those options to do things to either make it faster, cheaper, better, in a manner that we can discuss with both sides of the table and come to a kind of a structured decision-making process there. All right, that's great. All right, now let's turn it back to Kimberly for the final review.
Okay, thank you, Guy. So in review, we've gone over all of the issues that we talked about, all the bullets that we highlighted, the 7 points we wanted to cover. And just in summary, it's important to remember that enhanced attenuation is a plume remediation strategy. It's not a new technology, but it helps you achieve groundwater restoration goals by providing a bridge between your source zone treatment and M&A, or between M&A and slightly more aggressive methods if that becomes necessary. It provides an organized, scientific, and structured approach to implement treatment technologies. and helps you do that at appropriate times and in appropriate ways, and that there are various technologies that can be used or designed to reduce your source flux or increase your attenuation capacity of your aquifer, and that will, of course, help sure that your plume will stabilize and shrink. Moving to slide 85, the key concepts to remember is that it is a tool to help you transition your site through the complete remediation process, that it complements MNA and expands your remediation opportunities, and that it encourages energy efficiency and develops the best solutions for the environment. And on slide 86, we've got a few more points, including that the decision flowchart and enhanced attenuation integrates well within your existing regulatory framework. We haven't added any monkey wrenches to it that will complicate things. And hopefully it'll simplify the process of moving through your regulatory agencies and cleaning up your site. In summary, enhanced attenuation is not what you do, it's how and when you decide what you do. So I thank you very much, and I'll turn it over to Juliana.
Thank you, Kimberly. On slide 87, we are going to have time for more questions. And for our simulcast audience, you're welcome to start sending in questions using that orange question mark button at the top of the slide. Before we get to those questions, I do want to take you to our links to additional resources page, as well as to our feedback form. So you can select either of those sections of the slide. If you choose to go to the feedback form directly, you can look to the left under the Clue and Sun or on the links page, and you can see a way to travel between the links page and the feedback page. We do ask that everyone on the call today take just a few minutes to fill out our feedback form. We use the information and do appreciate your feedback about today's training class. On the links page, in section 1, download today's ITRC training is going to allow you to download the presentation that you've seen during today's training class. In addition to what you've seen on the slides, the notes section of the downloaded versions provide additional information. Today's training class introduced the ITRC Technical and Regulatory Guidance for Enhanced Attenuation of Chlorinated Organics, the ECO-1 document. This link is going to take you over to the ITRC website where you can download a copy of this document, and we do encourage you to review the document now that you've heard about what's included in it. We also on the ITRC webpage have a team page for enhanced attenuation of chlorinated organics, as well as the resources and links. In section 2, other related ITRC documents, we referred to a few of these during today's training class. Here's some items that you may find specifically of use, and also I encourage you to go to the ITRC website and look over all of the information that's available there for you. And in section 3, we list some websites and software. Again, some of these are things that we've mentioned during today's training class. We do now want to take questions from our audience. For our simulcast audience, it's back on the slides. It's the orange question mark button that's going to allow you to send in questions. For our phone line audience, you're welcome to ask questions out loud. You need to unmute the phone at your location, as well as select *6 to unmute using our system. That's *6 to unmute, as well as unmute at your location. And please state your name and location that you're calling in from. Do we have questions to start from our phone line audience?
Yeah, I have a question.
Yes, and who are you?
This is Sterling Turner. I'm with GES in Richmond, Virginia.
Thank you.
My question is, and I know this this whole presentation and EA in general is very much from the management view and transitioning between different stages and milestones of the remediation and closure process. But just to dial down a little bit into sort of the details of that, I was really thinking about how performance monitoring, whether in M&A or active remediation, is, you know, a lot of the effort of the work at these sites, as well as can turn into a lot of the cost. And I was just wondering that if the presenters had any thoughts on performance monitoring and trying to assimilate that, that the data needs, I guess, you know, as you transition back and forth between these different stages.
Richard, you want me to give that a shot?
Yeah, go ahead.
Well, I think your point's great, but, you know, and realistically, we're pretty good at performance monitoring, and, you know, there's lots of data that's collected, but it seems to be that the hang-up is decision-making processes and what we do with that data. And the idea is that we have a framework here that talks about those, you know, we so often disconnect source zone treatment and plume treatment. You know, we know they're two different things. We treat them differently, but we don't connect them well. You know, so the type of plume you have, what you're trying to do, all those things have a lot to do with your performance monitoring. But for the most part, we're comfortable with the practitioners out there doing a good job on performance monitoring. I mean, gosh, guys, any Superfund site we've ever had, there's just reams and reams and reams and reams of performance monitoring. But moving the process ahead, or more importantly, changing the process to do something better, faster, cheaper, has been a bugaboo.
Right. So, I would agree entirely with that. The optimization process, there are two points, there are several points, but two come to mind immediately when we talk about it, is setting milestones ahead of time and then comparing your performance data to those milestones to help in the decision-making process. And optimization is the other. We collect a lot of data, but how often is the system, as part of the process, as part of a quarterly or semi-annual process, how much optimization is done using those data? Things like SVE systems and different sorts of injection systems, you can certainly set up dead spots in those systems after a period of operation, and you can maximize recovery by shifts in the operation, moving airflow, different directions, those sorts of things. So, you know, using those data in the context of the framework means using them to make milestone decisions and using them to make performance decisions that relate to these transitional phases in a way that is not, to my knowledge, written into most regulatory guidance.
Yeah, I think Richard brings up that point. You know, because if both the site regulator and the responsible parties say this is how we're going to do it, then conversations occur within the context of the framework, and the decision-making process is going to be less surprising to both sides. Hopefully, all being technically competent, we come to the same decisions.
This is Juliana. I'll also refer you to additional resources on ITRC on remediation process optimization. We have internet-based training and guidance documents on that topic, and you may want to look there for additional information. Thank you.
Thank you.
We have a simulcast question from Chris Lee at National Semiconductor in Santa Clara, California. Is there general guidance for what is considered to be an acceptable remediation timeframe?
Yeah, I'm not aware of it. I can sort of, this is Richard. I'm not aware of it. Some guidances do have for particular phases of a remedial effort have some things written in. I know in Florida they have if you're going to approach a site with natural attenuation, there's a requirement that it meet the milestones or meet the goals in 5 years, or there needs to be a technical evaluation to understand why that didn't happen. I think this is exactly why we get stuck. We've been using the word stuck. You get stuck in a process, and you can't transition. There's nothing in the guidance that once you've got the record of decision, once you've got the system up and operating, and it's meeting the performance requirements, it just gets stuck and stays there. And that's one of the problems is I think I said it in my portion, I did say it in my portion, where there's nothing in the guidance that precludes you from doing these things, going in and optimizing or going in and making these decisions about transition. There's nothing in the guidance that forces it either.
Kimberly,
maybe somebody has more information than I do, but that's my experience.
Kimberly, you want to give us a regulatory point of view on that?
We don't really have an acceptable time frame. It's site by site, but we do know that we'd like to see it in our lifetime. And, you know, I know that's not a big help, but it's one of those things where you just have to look at it and say, is this the best we can do, or is there something more we can add in to bring it closer? We like to see 30 years here, but that's not always realistic.
In many cases, we're actually, the time frame question is not, explicitly the regime of the regulator. If you're the site owner and you want to do something with this thing, you know, that there's also that side of the time frame issue. You know, I can't do anything with this thing, or I'm limited in the decisions I can make on future use of this site. And if it has value, you know, you could get pushed from that side of the table, say, you know, it's worth more to us to do this faster. So, you know, hopefully both sides look at the time frame question.
A simulcast question from Barry Levin at the Memphis Division of Public Works in Tennessee. And this refers to slides 56, 58, and 61. So if you're using the Cluin system, along the left is a list of slide numbers, and you can jump back through those slides. Example scenario slides 56, 58, and 61. Can you comment on the factors causing the reduction in mass attenuation capacity from 5,500 to 200 to 100 kilograms per year, respectively?
Well, I mean, that is our hypothetical site. We just made those up. We use big numbers and big reductions. But the idea is that if, you know, those are really placeholders. And again, you're looking on the mass loading side, desorption, source zone solubilization, mobilization, and on the attenuation side, bio and chemical transformation, perhaps some adsorption.
The later case study, though, is a real site and had real reasons for the big reductions. So.
Right.
And then the ones you just mentioned.
So for the case study, did you want to describe the reasons for the reductions?
Was that, which was the slide number again that we were interested in on the case study?
That's my side. I can throw some things down. The first big reduction down gradient occurred when the site would use that box design where you dewater, you basically end up dewatering a portion of the site and pulling air through. The idea is that you can move a whole lot more air through an area than you can move water. And by dramatically reducing the mass, I think we took out 250 kilograms of mass in that area, that reduced the flux that would travel down gradient. So immediately down gradient, the concentrations dropped off significantly. The problem is, back in the source area, the concentrations hardly changed, even though there was a dramatic change in the amount of mass. That's because you're at the saturation, there's still MAPL present. So you got saturation concentrations, but there was not nearly as much flux. So the source area stays high, but the down gradient drops off dramatically. When the bio comes in, though, you can see this major shift in parent product to daughter product, and also a reduction, a further reduction in flux down gradient. And it had to do with the second phase. The first phase was just kind of physical recovery on the air, and the second phase was the bio. And the bio was quite efficient at knocking it out, knocking out additional flux down gradient. And you can see, I think by May of 2006, we only had 11 cysDCE down gradient. And that's not that Barney Well 3 was not very far away from the source area. So it was a significant effect.
We have a simulcast question from Andrew Henderson at Friends Environmental in Ottawa, Canada. What would be the level of uncertainty associated with the estimation of mass flux and other metrics in a complex geology site with limited characterization versus the level of uncertainty using a concentration-based approach?
Richard, you want me to tackle it first?
Sure.
So, you know, kind of similar to a previous question, I mean, really what we're looking at is a continuum of you know, data density, if you will. I'm more comfortable in many ways dealing with actually the flux data. I mean, all of us have looked at monitoring world data and watched it bounce around. And we're always afraid to say, well, you know, I think I want to see three quarters before I call this a trend. That it's not elevation fluctuation or something like that. Well, you know, not so much in this case where we have single point planes, single data point planes, but if we have multiple data points and planes, basically we're using the data to combine and give us a comprehensive or a cumulative evaluation of what's happening at the site. So myself, I always find flux data, you know, of varying density, but, you know, all things being equal, flux data more certain than concentration point data, particularly, you know, and then, of course, both of those will be enhanced by looking at multiple time points over time, multiple timelines.
I think this is a good question, and it's a tricky part of what we do. I think it depends a lot on what you're trying to do. I think it's almost operationally defined. Flux, basically, you're getting a velocity and multiplying it by a concentration. So if you don't have very good concentration data and you don't have great velocity data and you put them together, it won't be better. But one of the things that we found is that when you start to think in terms of flux, it drives your thought process towards getting better data or more focused data. On this site, our case study, we were able to locate the mass. And if you can find the mass and the major flow regimes, then you have a really good chance of cleaning up the site and understanding what's going on. If your data density isn't sufficient to understand, you know, where the mass is or where the major flow regimes are, then you're going to have a really hard time addressing concerns at the site. I think both flux data and concentration data suffer equally in that sense, but I think the concept of flux provides a paradigm under which you can, it drives you towards, I'm in another group called the Integrated DNAPL Site Strategy Group, and we just put together a little while back a mass flux document, and that training is ongoing. I think Juliana mentioned there's training for that now. Some members of that group feel strongly about high data density and mass flux being a really good way. You can have high concentrations in the clay zone and low concentrations in a high transmissivity zone. And the high transmissivity zones where it's all the mass is moving in the beginning of the in the beginning, and then as time goes by, now you've got this seeping out of mass, this diffusion of mass from the low transmissive zones acting almost like a secondary source. So, you know, flux allows a great way to talk about all that, but if you have very little concentration data, you're just going to tie that data together with velocity data, and you probably don't get a great improvement, but I think it's more about the way you think about the site than whether one is better than the other, and certainly concentration data are generally required by law, so you're going to have those anyway.
Thank you. We have questions from our phone line audience. Remember, *6 to unmute your line. Also, I'll point out that on May 12, we have an internet-based training on use and measurement of mass flux and mass discharge. If you're interested, you can register for that training class from the ITRC website, www.itrcweb.org. If you are interested now, we do have an archive available, and again, from the ITRC website under internet-based training, there's a link where you can access the archives of previous training classes, and we have offered the mass flux training class previously, so it is available in the archives. You can listen to it right away. Or if you'd like to listen to a live class, that's on May 12 at 11 a.m. Eastern Time. For our online audience, remember to unmute at your location and *6 to unmute using our system. I'll also remind you we are looking for feedback from everyone in the audience today. From the links page, you can access the feedback under the Clue and Sun. It's the third button listed. We do use the information and appreciate you taking just a few minutes to give us your feedback. We are out of simulcast questions, so I'll go ahead and wrap up today's training class. I'd like to thank our instructors and our participants for joining us today. I realize that we've had some severe weather along the East Coast, so I really appreciate y'all joining us today. Again, please fill out that feedback form. We use the information and appreciate you taking just a few minutes to give us your feedback. More information about ITRC is available on the ITRC website, www.itrcweb.org. Thanks again for joining us, and have a great day.